Hey listeners, my fabulous colleagues Amy Bernstein and Amy Gallo are back with a new season of Women at Work. You know, it's your guide to whatever you're facing at work, from anxiety to Gen AI. Listen to new episodes of Women at Work every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the HBR IdeaCast from Harvard Business Review. I'm Sarah Green Carmichael. This is the episode where we talk about the upcoming issue. In this case, it's the September 2015 issue. And as always, I'm joined by Amy Bernstein, editor of HBR. Amy, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here.
So I thought we'd start with the spotlight. This is the part of each issue that focuses on a specific topic, several different articles, tackling it from different perspectives. The spotlight this time is design thinking. So start by just telling me sort of why design thinking, and then what have we got in this package?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, a lot of people asked us that when we first started noodling on the topic. And the reason we wanted to look at design thinking is that we and others have noticed that design thinking has really kind of come out of product development and is starting to suffuse the entire organization. You're seeing it used to create strategy. We have an article in the package that's actually an interview with Indra Nooyi of Pepsi, where she actually talks about that. It's being used for all kinds of operational improvement, and it's also being used for change management. In fact, that's really the subject of the article by Tim Brown, of course, of IDEO, Roger Martin of the Rotman School. This article is called Design for Action, and they're talking about something that they're calling intervention design, and that's using design thinking methods to manage change both inside the organization and with your customers. It's a very cool idea that they have documented and kind of systematized. It's been quite clear, you know, that smart design leads to the success of many products, you know, Apple, need I say more? But design is being used in increasingly complex contexts to design whole ecosystems. So think about the design of hybrid cars. You know, it's not just about the car. It's about user behavior. It's about the ecosystem around the car. You know, how are you going to fuel the car and so forth? So gaining acceptance of the quote-unquote design artifact, which is what sits at the center of design thinking, you have to have something you can play with. Mm-hmm. To get the user reaction, right, and keep refining, has kind of raised new complexities. The more innovative a new design is, the more resistance it's likely to create. Think about how when you ask a customer to start using products in different ways, one of the things that Apple did so brilliantly is with the creation of the iPod, they made it very simple, a very design thinking way of doing things. They said 1,000 songs in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
But others had tried to introduce similar MP3 players, the Zune, very famously. And no one had boiled it down to that very simple proposition, and they all died, right? It was just too much of a behavior change to push on people. So the point of this article is that you have to apply design thinking to the introduction of a new product or system itself. That's intervention design, and that's how you get buy-in. Intervention design, as they see it, grew organically out of the iterative prototyping that designers did to help understand the customer's reactions to new products. But iterative prototyping, this rapid prototyping, not only created better offerings, it was a great way to get the organizational funding and commitment, particularly from the top, because it improved the chances of success.
Mm.
And it reduced fear of the unknown. So any of us who's tried to sell an idea understands how much you're dealing with this sort of kind of tacit fear of the unknown. Intervention design uses prototyping to get buy-in in the same way, but it extends it to the interactions with all of the stakeholders, not just the customers. And that's what this article describes. It has really cool examples from MassMutual. They wanted to get young people under 40 to start buying insurance, and they came up with a whole new way of doing this. It's very cool. A new school system in Peru They talk about hybrid cars. Anyway, it's a great read, and I know I learned a lot from it.
The other thing, Amy, that I really liked about this design thinking package and the other stuff we have going on the website is that there's stuff here for every level. If you have been doing design thinking for a long time, mm-hmm. there's new stuff here for you. If you were just completely confused by trying to follow that and don't really know what we're talking about, well, we have a 2-minute video that will explain to you what exactly design thinking is as a kind of introduction to the topic.
Yeah, and we've actually built up a wonderful corpus of material over the years. You know, the original design thinking article by the same two authors came out in this magazine, what, 15 years ago or something like that.
Mm.
One of the features of this package that I think is really cool is the one about how Samsung became a design powerhouse. And that really shows you design thinking in action.
So there's another article in the issue, not in the spotlight, in the feature well, that also talks about reaching customers and convincing customers to do things from a totally different perspective. And this is a piece that really focuses on certainty and how certain customers can be and how that affects your ability to persuade them. And I thought this was just such a cool, nuanced, smart piece. Tell me a little bit about this piece.
Yeah, I agree with you because it sort of separates the concept of certainty from persuasion, right? And it helps you see how they work together. It's written by a professor at Stanford Business School, and his co-author is a professor at Northwestern's Kellogg Schools. Think about certainty and how it shapes our behavior. The more certain we are of a belief, regardless of whether it's correct, right, the greater its influence on what we do. So people who are certain of their opinions about a product are more likely to buy sooner, to spend more, and to recommend.
Mm.
These are really important things to know. And there's plenty of data to show this. Certainty, say the authors, is the catalyst that turns attitudes into action. So their example is two people flying Virgin Air. They're asked to rate their experience. One person gives it a 9. It was a great experience. The other person gives it a 9. It was a great experience. Well, marketers up until now have been tempted to think of those two customers as very similar. But one of those customers is a frequent flyer, takes Virgin, you know, once a month, and really is committed to flying that airline. They're collecting points, and they really love the service. The other one has flown Virgin for the first time. Yeah, this was a great experience. But you can imagine that that person might think to herself, who's to say the next experience will be this good? The first person, the frequent flyer, is far more likely to recommend Virgin. You know, there's a certain kind of association. There's a badge there, right? That's who you want to focus on. That's the person who is more certain of her view and therefore more likely to be a better customer. So the researchers, the authors, say that certainty is really poorly understood and therefore we don't make the most of it. They identified four levers for increasing certainty. I'm not going to go deeply into them, but I'll just say them. Consensus, repetition, ease. And ease is really how readily your view occurs to you or an idea occurs to you. And then defense, defending your view. We all know how that will harden us into a position, right? Anyway, a great article for marketers, but also anyone who is trying to sell a product, an idea. Again, I learned a lot from that one.
Well, and what is so interesting about it is that we've sort of put it in the marketing category, but you could just as easily see some of this insight into certainty and helping people become more certain and persuading them and the four levers you just talked about. You could really see that sort of changing how you think about persuading people around the office, too.
Absolutely. And really, salesmanship, you cannot function in our world where you manage through influence rather than command and control without sales skills. You have to be able to bring people to your position, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you need to be able to get buy-in. You know, in fact, I see the connection to the first package we were just talking to because so much of intervention design is about getting buy-in. So I love that you made that connection. I hadn't even thought of that.
Thanks, Amy. Okay, now the next topic is This one is totally different from what we've talked about before, cybersecurity. This is one of those topics that I think gets so much attention, especially in the media when things go wrong, but there's not that much out there in terms of really telling you how to improve. So tell me a little bit about sort of what makes this piece different.
Yeah, this one's called Cybersecurity's Human Factor, Lessons from the Pentagon. You know, I was surprised just at the outset that the Pentagon was a paragon of cybersecurity, right? It's written by Sandy Winnefeld, who was a vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and a Navy admiral until August. He just retired. And then Christopher Kirchhoff, who was a special assistant to the Joint Chiefs. And then the third author is David Upton, who's probably familiar to some of our readers. He's with Oxford Said School, and he is a real specialist in cybersecurity. What makes this article kind of different and worth your attention is that we actually have a lot, we in the private sector, to learn from the U.S. military, which has been tightening its cyber defenses for the past 6 years. And in the past year alone, it has managed to repel more than 30 million intrusions. Think about that. They do this by focusing on human error. That's absolutely core to their security strategy. And the point behind this is the human error everywhere, no matter what kind of organization you're in. So the human error, it's users, it's administrators, any kind of human error is what opens the door to the vast majority of successful attacks. To address this, the Defense Department has been borrowing from the high reliability, and that's a thing, high reliability organizations, the high reliability practices of the U.S. Navy's nuclear program, which is not suffered a single accident in its 6 decades.
Okay? That's amazing.
Right? So Winnefeld and his co-authors describe how the military does this and how business leaders can apply these practices in their own firms. And they focus on 6 cultural principles: integrity, depth of knowledge, procedural compliance, forceful backup, a questioning attitude. What they're saying there is investigate anything that looks weird, right?
Mm-hmm.
And formalities, you know, just formal processes, never allowing exceptions. It works. It seems restrictive, but it is absolutely necessary when you consider what's at stake.
Well, and I noticed in the article that in the past year alone, something like 30 million attempts have been foiled by the military, attempts at hacking. So that's also just incredible. I mean, these people seem like they know what they're doing.
Yeah, they absolutely do. Yeah, they do. You know, it's not perfect, but when you think of, it seems like the almost weekly revelations about data breaches and how terrifying that is and how it touches every single one of us. This article is tremendously important to understand how to cut down on those.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like this is like the Model T Ford era of the internet. And it's like we're amazed that we have this horseless carriage thing. And it doesn't matter that it gets like a mile to the gallon and breaks down and has no seatbelts. And, you know, so I look forward to articles like these that will, you know, help us get to the next level.
Yeah. And to help us understand what practices we really ought to just adopt without questioning so much, you know? And clearly you need to have a kind of strict procedural approach to cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. Take it from those who know.
Yes, right? Yes, definitely. All right. Now, the last feature article in every issue is always something that we hope will help the reader manage his own career better or her own future a little bit better. And this month, it's How to Embrace Complex Change by Linda Brim. Tell us a little bit about this piece.
Yeah, Linda Brim is an emeritus professor at INSEAD, and she's the one who gave us the concept of the global cosmopolitan. Many of our readers probably know about that. But, you know, this is an article for just about anyone listening to this podcast. For executives working in dynamic businesses, you know, any kind of business, global businesses especially, they face transitions all the time to new roles, organizations, industries, geographies. They need to constantly adapt to new technologies, new work groups, strategies, new ways of thinking and behaving. Yet even the most seasoned professionals, leaders, managers find this difficult. management researchers have, you know, more to say than you can shake a stick at about the best way to approach organizational change, but very few people really address the personal transitions. We need a blueprint for success. We don't have one. Our author, Linda Brim, has worked with MBA students and executives for decades, and she's developed a framework that helps them get through these changes. And it involves what she refers to as the seven C's. And I will tick those off for you. They're complexity, clarity, confidence, creativity, commitment, consolidation, and change. Read the article. You see how they all work together. And you'll see that you can actually get to each one of these in a way that helps you navigate these uncomfortable transitions. Mm.
Well, and change is something we all have to just get better at. I mean, it's not easy for anybody, so.
No, it's always going to make you uncomfortable. And it is the provocation for so much management thinking.
Okay, now the last article I just wanted to ask you quickly in the issue about is a first-person account by Norman Winarski, the president of SRI Ventures, which is the company behind Siri. Tell us a little bit about this piece.
So Siri, you know, the voice in your pocket, right, came to us through a kind of, I would describe it as a disjointed path. Winarski and his colleagues at SRI, which was the Stanford Research Institute before it became SRA, recognized that the smartphone's growing capabilities, you know, this tiny computer you hold in your hands, would eventually put communication power that used to belong to supercomputers in everyone's pocket. They believed that the company that they were starting was well suited to leading this revolution, but their plans didn't quite pan out the way they had originally thought. They didn't think that they would create a standalone venture. They had talked to dozens of telecom carriers and handset providers, gear makers, with the idea of jointly starting a project to license the technology. Very few of those prospective projects actually leveraged the full power of what would become Siri. They used only parts of the original vision, and it was really just not satisfying to Norman Winarski and his crew. So they decided to drop the idea of the joint venture and to create their own. Creating the speech-to-text part of Siri was the easy part for them. The hard part was analyzing words in order to understand the user's intent and then reason out and answer the request.
Well, isn't that the hard part for all of us when we're talking to other people?
Well, you know, no kidding. If only we could figure out how to monetize it. But you know, Siri is now a fact of all our lives. So this is a great tale. It's totally worth a read.
I may be biased, but I think it's the best article you have published all year.
Very high praise, very high praise. Well, Amy, thank you so much again for talking with us today.
Always a pleasure.
That was Amy Bernstein, editor of Harvard Business Review. For more, visit hbr.org.